Blog Talk Radio.
It might have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over the luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her. But he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner. The Soviet Union, a scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's optimism fell at the first hurdle. The cheese pavilion, and the only noise I hear is the sound of someone stacking chairs and mopping up spilled beer, and someone asking questions and basking in the light at the 15 fame-filled minutes of the fanzine writer. In pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment for my usual excuses, while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the Great Leap Forward. Sales are organised and pamphlets have been posted. Even after closing time, there's still parties to be hosted. You can be active with the activists or sleeping with the sleepers while you're waiting for the Great Leap Forward. One leap forward, two leap back. Will politics get me the sack? Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Blacklist, I want to be on it. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Well, it's a mighty long way down rock and roll from top of the pot to throwing a towel. When you're waiting for the Great Leap Forward. There's no one out there understands. It's like your own revolution and cut out the middle man. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Perfect world, we're all singing tune, but this is reality. Skip the road. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. So join the struggle while you make the revolution. It's just a t-shirt away.
Begun on the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City yesterday.
Wave after wave of occupations are taking place across the United States. October 6th, a new one begins in Washington, D.C. But what happened yesterday is one for the history books. And I'm not going to hold you up, folks. I'm going to put him on. Charles M. Young. Chuck, as they call him at thiscan'tbehappening.net, is a former random notes editor at Rolling Stone magazine, the one that broke into big print Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Ralph Nader, the interviews. Music reviewer for Musician Magazine, Playboy, and Atlantic Monthly, and Men's Journal. He's part of the important This Can Be Happening right now, so we'll go right back into this. Charles M. Young. Listeners, we have from This Can't Be Happening, Charles M. Young, who, if he lets me, I'll call him Chuck. He's written for Rolling Stone magazine, contributor, regular contributor there, and many of the TCBH staff guys, they all have distinguished literary histories. I mean, the trail ends up at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Charles Young wrote a piece about 13 reasons of the occupation of Wall Street, and I've been reading parts of them of the 13th on air as I started yesterday before Dave Lindorf came on. But Chuck has been at the Occupy Wall Street continually. You must live up near there, right, Charles?
Well, I live about it's probably 4 or 5 miles from Wall Street, but it's, you know, so it's like you know, a few minutes on the subway to get down there. It's, I mean, it's not inconvenient getting to Wall Street from where I live, but
right.
I'm not physically close there. I can't. It would be a burden to make the 4 or 5 mile walk every morning.
Right. Well, you're closer than us out in Kansas, and thanks for letting me talk with you this morning. It's early in the morning for us here. You know, this is an interesting development. Yesterday, while we were doing our show, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people, I guess, going towards the Brooklyn Bridge. Could you, like I said, first to describe what you saw yesterday, and maybe tell us a little bit about the organization, if you can call it that, of Occupy Wall Street?
Well, I had a very long day of reporting yesterday. It was one of the most fun and exhilarating days I've ever had in my life. And it was also pretty scary on the Brooklyn Bridge. What happened was at noon there was at Union Square, which is many thousands of mostly young women, but some you know, middle-aged and older women who were. It was a big protest of sexual violence, and but they were all dressed like a parody of Victoria's Secret, you know. All these women walking around in their underwear, and they walk from Union Square down to Union Square is 14th Street. They walk down over to 2nd Avenue and then down to 3rd Street and then back up to Union Square, and then they had this rally there. And I had so much fun on the, you know, on this at that demonstration, and that started at noon, and I was there for a few hours. And when I went back downtown for I went back downtown to the Occupy Wall Street thing, which is in Zuccotti Park, which is 2 blocks north of Wall Street. That's at the very bottom of Manhattan. People in Kansas, I don't know how aware they are of New York City geography, but, you know, New York, Manhattan is this, you know, this island of granite in the middle of the Hudson River, and it's about 10 or 12 miles long, and the Wall Street area is at the very bottom, southern tip of it. And that's where Zuccotti Park is, and that's the park that the demonstrators have taken over. And when I got back down there from the slut walk, I got off the subway, and there was this huge river of people walking by, and I realized it was this march to Brooklyn. And I just, you know, I went from the slut walk to the march to Brooklyn, and it was the idea of that march was, you know, kind of vague. It was to show solidarity with the people of Brooklyn, or
mm-hmm.
and the police seemed to be pretty cooperative. You know, they weren't wading into anybody. While we were actually in Manhattan, but you know, when we got to, and my part of the demonstration was clearly steered onto the walkway of the Brooklyn Bridge. There's the Brooklyn Bridge is, it's kind of hard to describe, but there's the top lane on the Brooklyn Bridge is a walkway with kind of a floor of wooden slats, and you can see down to the traffic and even to the river below through the slats. But you walk across this thing, and then you can walk from Manhattan to Brooklyn over this quite beautiful bridge. I think it's the most beautiful, or one of the most beautiful bridges in the United States. And but below, if you look to your, as you're walking to Brooklyn, if you look below, you see the, if you look to your right, you see there's a lane of cars about 30 or 40 feet below you who are driving to Brooklyn. And on the other side of the walkway, you can look down, and there's a lane, you know, two lanes of cars going from Brooklyn to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
On the on looking over the right side where the cars were going to would normally be going to Brooklyn from Manhattan, there were, it was this you know, we got you know, I was walking about a quarter of the way over the bridge, and I noticed these city buses and paddy wagons backing up you know, on this bridge, and I could, why, and I thought, why are they backing up into traffic?
Yeah.
And I could not figure out what was going on. And then we got further on, and you know, that's where we started seeing the arrests, and there were all these people who were in handcuffs at this point, because I was at the back of the march.
Oh. Uh-huh.
There were all these people in handcuffs, and they were being, you know, hauled into paddy wagons and buses and stuff, and then taken off to, you know, to jail at Police Plaza. And I thought this is really weird. I had no idea that people were going to be doing civil disobedience,
mm-hmm,
at such a serious level, where they'd be blocking traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, I got to go.
Let me make my point. When I got back to the demonstration, they at Zuccotti Park, they had reports from people during the General Assembly at Zuccotti Park, and the people who went onto the bridge were not aware that they were committing civil disobedience. The police opened up their line, whether by accident or by design, and these people, the people who marched onto that bridge, were, you know, essentially lured into getting arrested. Now, so I don't, you know, the police were looking for another confrontation. Now, did they want to make mass arrests as a way of discouraging people from going to Zuccotti Park? You know, I have no idea what their motive could have been, but I don't believe that the leaders of this march went there with the idea of blocking traffic to Brooklyn. Whether it was a crowd control mistake by the cops, or it was designed by the cops because they wanted to make mass arrests. That's what happened, but I you know, I've heard, you know, none of the demonstrators that I've talked to, and I've talked to quite a few, knew that they were committing civil disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
They thought the cops wanted to divide the demonstrators, and some of them to go on the traffic throughway, and some of them to go on the walkway. Now, I was up on the walkway, and there was quite a crowd control up there because everybody wanted to watch the arrests, and it was dangerously crowded up there, and there were a lot of people climbing up on the cables.
Wow.
And they were climbing up on the lampposts and stuff along the walkway, and they could have fallen off and just died, you know. It was like the you know, kids climbing up on the speaker towers at Woodstock or something, you know.
Right.
It was frightening up there, and you didn't know what was going on. And then, but anyways, I walked to Brooklyn. I found some people, you know, by happenstance, I found some people I knew on the other side at Brooklyn, and we talked for a while, and the cars going by from Brooklyn into Manhattan were honking their horns in support. There were a lot of people on rooftops in Brooklyn who were cheering the demonstration. They were waving their arms and cheering. And that had to have been a little unnerving for the cops because, you know, the people of Manhattan and Brooklyn are have been, in my experience, very supportive of this demonstration. People are so angry at Wall Street, even in New York, which is, you know, kind of depends on Wall Street,
right,
taxes and stuff. But you know, the hedge fund owners and these people who ran the national economy, the world economy, into the ground have been so irresponsible and so greedy that everybody who works for a living is angry with them now. And so the demonstration is picking up a lot of momentum. Now you can ask me anything you want.
Well, I'm dying to. Well, I got a video from freakoutnation.com, and it shows clearly the police leading the Occupy Wall Street bunch, at least a portion of them, I guess, based on what you told me, up the entranceway to the bridge, like the on-ramp. It looks like the entrance ramp drive for automobiles. They're right at the front. The police are right at the front. There's a phalanx of them marching almost in unified step, leading this huge mess up. It's actually a 14-second clip on YouTube, leading from the front. You must have been in the back,
well,
it's insane, right?
Yeah, I was in back. Well, that's good to hear. That confirms what I've heard from every eyewitness that I personally interviewed yesterday. I haven't looked at everything on YouTube, and I haven't read all the articles yet today. But I'm trying to write my, I need to write my own article about this, and then I really want to go back to the demonstration at some point today. There's always, you know, there are long kind of down periods of boredom, but when something happens, it's pretty heavy. And
oh, it's
yesterday
epic.
was a very heavy day.
It was epic, and I'll tell you, another video posted at the flyer, also provided by a Kansan. I don't think he wants to be named on air, but he's a prominent member of the Kansas Progressive Caucus. He actually dropped everything and went to New York to witness this just 48 hours ago. And he filmed some incredible footage of the takedown of the leader of the front of the march. And it looks like appears to be in the middle of the bridge. And there's this really poignant footage of this big banner that says "We the People," and at the front of it. And it's just incredible footage. I mean, it's epic. What you witnessed yesterday is going to become epic. But I had one question, a tactical question. It's visible. I mean, we can prove that the police led the march on the entrance ramp to the Brooklyn Bridge. There's photographic evidence of it at YouTube from freakoutnation.com. And you can watch it yourself and see. And they're leading him up there. Then I understand, and the phrase seems to be now popular, kettling, which I believe comes from the uprisings, or whatever you want to call them, in England recently about the students upset because their tuition was going up and all these other cutbacks are going down. Kettling is the word, because I heard, now I don't know if you can confirm this, that they threw plastic netting at some point in the back of the march, and they sort of captured these people on the bridge, and then arrested everybody that was on the bridge. The walkway people, I don't know. The guy, the Arkansan who filmed this, he it looked like he was filming from the walkway down onto the crowd. It looked like that. So my question was, how many lanes of traffic are on the Brooklyn Bridge, say going from Manhattan to Brooklyn? How many lanes of traffic are there?
Well, there's three levels to the bridge. The top level is the walkway, which is basically a wide sidewalk, maybe the size of one lane of traffic, and then there's the next level is two lanes going to Brooklyn and two lanes going to Manhattan, and then below that there's another two lanes to Brooklyn and another two lanes to Manhattan.
So there's a lot of lanes of traffic there.
Yeah.
So,
but there weren't any demonstrators on the lowest level, to my knowledge. They were on the the level below the walkway. That's where they were steered, and the from what you're telling me, and from what I've managed to glean from the internet, and from what I heard at the General Assembly last night, it sure looks like the police were planning to trap a whole bunch of people and arrest them. And that's really stupid, among other problems. And that video that you just described. I mean, another thing that's on that video is these guys in white shirts, the police deputy inspectors who are, supervisors. I mean, it shows the guys in white shirts just wading into the front of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And they are clearly looking for a fight. I mean, they're the, I don't know what you'd call them, the brown shirts who actually have white shirts or something. But that stuff gets really ugly. But it's not there. It hasn't descended completely into an us versus them mentality of the demonstrators versus the cops. There are a lot of demonstrators who've had pretty good experiences with the cops. You know, there's only a couple of places around Zuccotti Park where you can go to the bathroom, and that's true for the cops as well as thousands of demonstrators. So you find, zillions of, you find them waiting in line at McDonald's or Burger King, and the demonstrators and the cops waiting to get into the bathroom, they have nothing to do but talk to each other. So, they've gotten to be kind of friendly.
Sure.
And the demonstration is, it's very mixed ethnically and sexually. I don't think there are probably a few more men there, but it's, it's a very, welcoming, egalitarian place for everybody of all sexes and ethnicities and stuff. And, there's these, the young cops aren't going to, refuse to talk to an attractive young woman who,
right,
waiting in line to go to the bathroom, and I think at the lowest rank of the cops and the demonstrators, I think there have been some some friendships struck up.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times is running again from Freak Out Nation. I clicked the link. It said the quote was, from the New York Times, an article published this morning. According to the New York Times, one law enforcement official said it was, quote, a planned move on the protesters, unquote. And that was an article by Al Baker, Colin Moynihan, and Sarah Maislin-Nur that's out now. But the reason I ask about the lanes from Manhattan to Brooklyn, if the police, let's assume the police are saying what they're saying is that they're impeding traffic. That's why they arrested 700 people. After they led them, it's quite clearly they led them on there. Why didn't they just have, leave one lane of the, I guess, four lanes on two levels going from Manhattan to Brooklyn? Why didn't they just leave one of those lanes open and let the marchers, how could they call it impeding traffic if there's those kind of, forgive the abuse, choices to be made by the drivers leaving Manhattan to go to Brooklyn? It sounds like they had an option they could have gone. The police could have escorted, even if the crowd was taking over one level, they could have closed off that level, let the demonstrators cross the bridge, and allowed and steer and moved vehicle traffic to the one remaining two-lane level of the bridge that would still get them there. My protest, traffic might have been. This is a setup, man. There's just no way around it. People are calling it a kettling or whatever. This is it's really sort of sick that the cops would do this to so many people. In Kansas, when you get busted on a Friday night or a Saturday, you don't get out till Monday. Do you know if any of these people are getting out?
I do not. I would need to go down to the GA to find that out.
Well, was this a substantial number of the demonstration? Does this knock everybody out? Were the most the leaderless, unorganized? Were the most determined, courageous? To use Chomsky's words, the most honorable ones on the bridge level or on the walkway or what? I mean,
it's way too late to arrest a few leaders and stop this demonstration.
Oh,
I mean, that's what was really interesting about yesterday. I mean, this has now reached the level where it's a scene, and by that, you know, in one of the articles I wrote about this, I said this is a spark, and all it needs now is a little gasoline, which I meant metaphorically.
Right.
And of course, and the thing is that it's now exploding. I mean, there are people coming from all over the world to this. There's a guy at the demonstration right now who quit his job in Finland and flew to the United States just so he could be part of this demonstration in Zuccotti mm-hmm. Park. And there are people coming from all over the United States. And if you talk to the food people in Zuccotti Park, you know, who are distributing free meals to the demonstrators, they are getting orders from all around the United States. You know, they're getting, you know, all these, I mean, people in Arizona and Arkansas and, you know, Iowa are phoning in orders for pizza at the local restaurant.
I heard that.
And there's almost more food at this. I mean, yesterday they were actually having to throw out some of the fruit because it had, you know, it's already beginning to rot. I mean, they've gotten so much food. And and they've got a sanitation crew down there that cleans up after all of this stuff. I mean, the park is in remarkably good shape, you know, given that there are thousands and thousands of people there. And, you know, there's already too many people for that little park.
Uh-huh.
And if the police thought that they could stop the momentum of this by making mass arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge, and that just sounds to me like what they thought they were doing, that, you know, they failed completely. They do not understand what they're facing, and they don't have the psychology to understand what they're facing. Mayor Bloomberg lives in a bubble of money, and it's a very big bubble, and it's a very thick bubble. You know, he's worth $18 billion. He's the 18th richest man in, or no, he's the 23rd richest man in the United States. And you know, people with that kind of money, they really don't know what's going on. And he's beginning to panic. I mean, if you read some of his quotes about this stuff, he is clueless, he's confused, and he's afraid. And well, he should be. And if that's true for him, you know, all his buddies at the hedge funds and Goldman Sachs and, you know, the big banks and stuff, I mean, they're beginning to panic too, because this is not going away. You know, they're going to, they don't know how to, and I mean, at this point, if they tried to clear the park, there would be, it would be extremely ugly. It would be so ugly that it would be, you know, of historic significance. Actually, the demonstration right now, it is historic. I mean, this is the best demonstration I've been to for years and years. It's something new under the sun in the United States. The closest precedent is Madison, Wisconsin, but this is you know, what's going on in Zuccotti Park is even new there. You know, I mean, this egalitarian form of organization, there's no small group of people that they can arrest and stop this. You know, because they're so well organized and they're taking care of that park and they're taking care of each other. And you know, it's like Woodstock now. You know, where people are going to think, you know, I've got to be there or I have missed history. But when, I mean, I was a teenager in Wisconsin when Woodstock happened. And I remember seeing the ads for Woodstock and Rolling Stone that summer, and talking with a couple of my friends about, you know, how can we get there? You know, do we take the bus? You know, and where do we get the money to get to this to this thing? And we ended up not going. It seemed impossible when you were getting there from Wisconsin when you were underage. I suppose if I'd had a little more initiative, I could have gotten there. But if you missed Woodstock, you know, I regret missing Woodstock for the rest of my life. If I was there, I would have been very uncomfortable, but I'd have stories to tell for the rest of my life. And I know a lot of people who were at Woodstock. They all have good stories about it, and they were all, you know, part of this fraternity of people who, you know, who saw this incredibly important social event in American history. And Zuccotti Park is beginning to get, is gradually growing to Woodstock proportions. I mean, and it has that momentum now. I mean, when I first started going down there, I just enjoyed it because there, you know, you were running into really nice people, and you could sit down on one of the park benches down there and have a really good conversation with somebody who was politically aware, and somebody who wanted to change the world, and somebody who was, you know, willing to confront Wall Street on its many crimes. And to, you know, to find people like that in the world is to feel less isolated and less alone. And that is, you know, is so much fun and so such an exuberant experience. But it's, you know, it's gone way beyond that now. I mean, it's very hard to be able to sit down and have a conversation with somebody, or even stand up and have a conversation with somebody, because there's so many thousands of people in that park now.
Wow.
I mean, it has really, really grown. That park is too small to hold them all. And then the police are going to have another decision to make, because there's going to be a lot of, you know, rowdy, angry people, you know, overflowing that park, and it's going to further annoy these jerks who work on Wall Street. And
well, geographically, how far? You said it was two blocks from actually the NYSE. I guess that's what the name of the building is, or something, isn't it? Where the actual stock exchange is located. How many blocks from there?
Oh, it's about, I would guess it's about three blocks.
Three? So if 500,000 people descend on that place, that's not going to, it'll engulf even the stock exchange building.
Oh, if 500,000 people showed up, that would be the greatest. That would be the greatest moment of, you know, the last 100 years or something. I mean, it's, you know, there's, you know, the numbers in the park vary a little bit by time of day.
Right.
It's sunny or rainy. Today is sunny, so I mean, they're going to be overflowing the park today. I'm quite sure. I don't, you know, I mean, what they're doing when I say overflow, they're just going into the streets around the park at this point. But I mean, if they had so many people, if the overflow reached the stock exchange, that would be that would really, really be wonderful. I mean, we'll see what happens.
Right.
You know, the weather's going to get colder, and it tends to rain a lot in the fall in New York City. I mean, who knows? But they've been dealing with the rain and things, the elements, pretty well so far.
Well, you know, there are these bizarre reports, and I call them bizarre. Maybe it's just normal. I mean, they said they won't let them have bullhorns, so there's this crowd dynamic taking place. Maybe it's a revolutionary new thing on how to organize. People, when they have this thing, roughly the structure is they do have a thing called General Assembly, and evident from what I've read, they repeat, the crowd repeats what the speaker is trying to say. Is that true? Have you seen anything like that?
That was one of the, I've sent through many General Assemblies. It's, if you're an American who's used to, watching television
right.
6 hours a day, it's probably going to seem kind of boring, but I personally find it very, very exciting because it is actual democracy at work, and most Americans don't really have any experience with actual democracy. They think that voting in a national election is democracy, and therefore they live in a free country when it's just a big, puppet show that's
right.
paid for and scripted by Wall Street. But this democracy there, they've worked out their own simplified, speedy version of Robert's Rules of Order to keep a very large, somewhat unruly crowd in control and keeping people informed. And they have this thing called the People's Microphone. And because the police will not allow loudspeakers, the People's Microphone, it forces all the speakers at the General Assembly to speak in very short phrases,
right.
one to four words, and then the people in toward the front of the crowd, they will shout, they will repeat the words of the speaker so as to amplify them so that people further back can hear them. Now, there's so many people now at the park that there's actually two waves of amplification. They'll say something like the ad hoc caucus of non-male identified individuals, and then the first group says, okay, the ad hoc caucus of
right.
non-male identified individuals, and then you hear it, and then the next wave goes, the ad hoc caucus of whatever, should meet in the southeast corner of the park at 3 o'clock.
That's yeah, so cool.
And then it gets repeated twice.
Right.
And then there are lots of little signals. If you want to clap or express your approval or say yes, you put your hands in the air and wiggle your fingers. If you disapprove, you put your hands down. You point your hands down and wiggle your fingers. if you want to prevent a consensus, if you want to express an ethical objection to something to a motion being discussed, then you put your arms up in a cross.
Really?
And they try to do things pretty close to consensus. They call it 9/10 consensus and stuff. I find it fascinating how that works, and they've got all these different working groups, community outreach. They're trying to get along well with the neighbors and things. And, there's a drum circle that goes on at all hours. There aren't too many people who live in the immediate neighborhood, so that the drum circle can just pound away, and not annoy that many people. But it creates a real kind of ominous slum in the background for everything,
It's sort of like a pulse going on in the background, like a pulse.
It is. It's a pulse. It's a speedy pulse. And, and all these Wall Street people walking by, you can tell by the, at first they were just curious, and a lot of them would go about their daily habits there weren't that many people in the park to begin with. So, people who normally ate lunch in the park would just continue eating lunch in the park. But now there's so many thousand people in there. It's you know, people who normally use the park for lunch eating and stuff or coffee drinking, they can't do that now. There's just too many demonstrators.
Well, I don't know if they sound that angry. I mean, they're angry, but it's not a day of rage type thing where they're running up and down the street busting windshields out with motorcycle helmets or football helmets.
No, when
on
I say
it.
Angry, I mean just the anger is very focused on the structure at Wall Street. You know, I doubt there have been very many people
right.
who have had any kind of personal bad experience. You know, I wish you could come here and just go to the park, Mike, because there are just, you know, I've had so many good conversations down there
right.
with interesting people. And you realize, I mean, you must feel, I mean, you do a radio show, they're at Radio Free Kansas and stuff, and you're talking with people like me around the country. So, you know you're not... you know you're not the only liberal around, but I think a lot of people who, you know, kind of sit in front of their computers
right.
and read blogs about how everything is going to hell and stuff,
right.
feel very isolated and alone.
Right.
And, I mean, I do myself. I mean, I wake up in the morning and read certain websites, and it puts me in such a mood that I just want to go back to bed for the rest of the day.
Well, I gotta tell you, you're far beyond a liberal, buddy, and I certainly resent that remark. You're right. With a sense of humor, that's a hell of a lot more. It's a hell of a lot different than any liberal I've ran into. But you know, I got to throw this at you. There's an anecdotal friend of ours on Twitter, not yours, but of our my crowd here I run with, and there's this very small crowd out here in Kansas. Of a woman who walked into McDonald's with here's the local connection. Evidently, she's topless, and she goes into McDonald's there in New York, right there out of Zuccotti Park. Walks into a McDonald's there with her top off, and she goes in and painted on her boobs is Bradley Manning. And that one anecdote, twittered by I guess the woman. I guess she got arrested and then released. Went out even out here to Kansas because this is where Bradley Manning's held at Fort Leavenworth, the disciplinary barracks.
That was the slut walk.
Oh,
that's exactly what the slut walk was. I mean, I don't know about that particular McDonald's incident, but you know, you see women around Zuccotti Park occasionally just take their tops off and write things on their body. And at the slut walk, I was talking to this one woman who was she's about 25 years old, and she had written on her arm in black and red magic marker. She'd written, "I'm going to kill you," you know. Stuff like that. And I said, well, I asked her what she did, and she's a medical student.
Oh, no, the feminine ferment.
You know, there are lots of women of, you know, all ages and, you know, shapes and sizes.
Right.
Just removed their tops walking around the Union Square yesterday, and you see that in Zuccotti Park as well. And and it's not a sexual thing. It's
right.
It's another way of protesting. It's a way of saying, I'm not going to observe your rules. And I'm going to use the shock value of this to advertise the plight of Bradley Manning or whatever, you know.
Right.
And when I went down to Zuccotti Park yesterday, I thought the slut walk was, you know, it was on the agenda of the general of. It had been placed on the agenda of the demonstration
mm-hmm.
by the media committee and stuff. So I thought the slut walk was actually going to be at Zuccotti Park. And the women in this demonstration are really, I think, quite a fascinating story. And so I came down to Zuccotti Park expecting to find the slut walk yesterday, and I didn't, and there was no there was no slut walk down there, and so I started, you know, it's like, well, what do I mean, I know it was scheduled for noon, you know, what the hell's going on here?
Right.
So I'm looking around the park, and it's like, who do I ask where the slut walk is?
And how do you ask?
And how do you ask that? You know, I mean, you don't go up to any woman and say, hey, baby, where's the slut walk? You know, I mean,
you might get killed.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, man. This is so cool.
So I'm asking all these different guys, you know, do you know where the slut walk is? You know, and nobody knew where the, none of the guys knew where the slut walk was. So, you know, I'm looking around the park, and I see this young woman, and she was 22 years old, and she was wearing blue jeans and a negligee. And on her, and across her back, between her shoulder blades, she had this, she had written in, you know, in letters that were about a foot high, slut, written on her back. And I thought, she's probably safe to ask where the slut was. And so, and she, you know, and we had this, you know, actually quite a nice conversation. So I went, it was from her that I found out that the slut walk was actually at Union Square, and it was organized by a coalition of feminist groups in New York who were actually objecting to something that the New York City Police Department had done. You know, there's a serial rapist running around Brooklyn right now. The Brooklyn police response to that is to tell women to dress less provocatively. You know, and they were saying, you know, that's crazy. We need... you know, if there's a sexual assault, it's the rapist's fault, not the woman. I mean, a woman can dress any way that she wants, and should be able to dress any way that she wants, and not be and not be subject to assault, or have anyone suggest that how she is dressed is some way the cause of you know, of rape. Their point is that rape is always a hate crime, and it has nothing to do with the way that you're dressed. And you know, I think that's a good point. But I ended up taking the subway up to the slut walk with three 22-year-old women who were, I must say, dressed very provocatively, you know, making their slut statement, and had a great conversation with them, and really, you know, quite a great time. I mean, I think they were, one of them was a little suspicious of me as an older male, but I think they could all tell that I was, you know, supportive and looking to give their cause a little publicity, so that, you know, I mean,
you need a this can't be happening press badge, brother. What's going on? Is Lindorf falling off the stool or something? He needs to get you a laminated official this can't be happening press badge, and I think that'd be even go better with the slut walk while you're there. This can't be happening at thiscan'tbehappening.net.
Well. Yeah, it was, well,
I got another question before my tape runs out.
Okay.
I've also read through Twitter, and I've been informed by some of my squad of people here that helped me out, that there's a WikiLeaks. There's a WikiLeaks truck there, or a Wikipedia truck, or something like. There's a WikiLeaks truck.
Yeah, it's like a big. It looks like a big ice cream truck. it says WikiLeaks on the side of it. I didn't actually pursue what they were trying to do.
Oh.
That truck has been there. I didn't notice it yesterday, and I'm not sure if it's still there. I think the cops may have restricted some parking around there.
Uh-huh.
There's a huge amount of the cops have Zuccotti Park surrounded with, you know, both with cops and they have all kinds of, you know, paddy wagons and you know, cherry pickers that take cops up and down for.
You mean those the buckets? On the cranes? The crane buckets? They got.
Yeah, it's like an elevated.
Yeah.
An elevator crane.
What the hell?
And they have a kind of a bulletproof cab.
Oh God.
That, and it takes a cop up, and you know, for observation purposes.
Was this 24/7?
Yeah.
And what
a waste. Like, it's a little like 1984, like or War of the Worlds or something there, especially at night when they've got like spotlights and stuff going on. But and there's this giant sculpture at the southeast corner of the park that looks like a Nazi tank trap on the beach at Normandy.
You mean a bunch of like I-beams or something, crossed I-beams?
Yeah, it's crossed I-beams, you know, stretching up to the heavens, and it's about three or four stories high. And to me, I find that sculpture just deeply, you know, oppressive, and it's painted red, blood red, and and the title of the sculpture is Joie de Vivre, Joy of Life. And
oh, my God. That's tasteless as hell.
Yeah, well, that's Wall Street's idea of art. They, you know, I-beams. So, I don't know. But, this demonstration has humanized the park. And
yeah.
It's gonna take a lot to make them go away. It's gonna take a whole lot to make these people go away. I mean, and if it keeps growing like this, it will be Woodstock. And you know, it's really something to see. I mean, it is so easy to get depressed when you read
your blogs
and your websites in the morning.
No shit.
And I know so many people who are just depressed because they've lost their job, or they can't pay their bills and stuff.
Or living with Brownback as governor. Go ahead.
Living with Brownback as governor, but you know, I'm living with Bloomberg as mayor. You know, the idea that Bloomberg is a moderate and Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, is, you know, is some kind of liberal is not right. You know, they're Bloomberg could cover the entire city budget gap out of his own wallet. You know, I mean, that's how crazy this is.
Uh-huh.
He's worth $18 billion, and the city budget gap is $4 billion. He could cover it out of his own wallet and still have $14 billion to live on.
Jesus Christ.
You know, and he's saying, oh, well, we can't possibly raise taxes on the rich. We're in the middle of a depression. And, you know, it's just these people, you know, America, the top 1%, they're crazy, and they're crazy with greed. And there are millions of people, there are millions of Americans out there who know that this country has gone crazy because of its incompetent and overtly evil ruling class. And they are doing something about it, and they're now in Zuccotti Park, and suddenly the idea that you don't have to be isolated, the idea that you don't have to be alone is, you know, is out there. And there is a real joie de vivre, joy of life in that park, and it has nothing to do with the sculpture.
Right on, and I want to tell you, you got it, listeners, go to This Can't Be Happening and bookmark it. Don't just wait on the flyer. Because there's enough outpouring of articles coming out of TCHB that I can't keep up with it, frankly. And so you got to just bookmark thiscan'tbehappening.net and get the reports from Charles M. Young. And I want to thank you. My tape's running out. I want to thank you for having me on. You got to come back on again, man. We got to need some reports regularly, or read your stuff, man. Make sure you get some stuff at the This Can't Be Happening, will you, man? Because I'm really on seat's edge. There are solidarity things, by the way, taking place in Lawrence, Kansas, just south of me, 30 miles, at the Bank of America, and there is currently at the Liberty War Memorial for World War One, the war to end all wars, in Kansas City, downtown Kansas City, Missouri. There is now a encampment forming there at the War Memorial. About 24 young people are camping out there, coming up at Bank of America in Lawrence as solidarity demonstration. I guess they're going to drive and commute over to Kansas, Missouri, and get involved in that. So I think you're right about this, dude. It's spreading like wildfire.
Yeah, there's 20 or 30 occupations going on around the country, and if you can't get to Zuccotti Park in New York or Washington, D.C. on October the 6th, I guess it is,
yeah,
when that demonstration starts, then, you know, just start your own occupation.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be amazed at all the nice people you meet in your town who show up. You know, it might not happen overnight, but if you stick it out, you'll discover that that people will start coming down and checking it out and taking part, and it's really fun, and it's the best thing you can do for your own mood. I've never gone to Zuccotti Park. I've been down there 9 or 10 times already in 2 weeks, and every time I come back, I I'm so excited I can't go to sleep at night.
Well, right, because we want to know, and thanks, Charles, for letting me get this time with you. Get back out there, man.
Okay.
All right. Hold on.
Thanks, Mike.
And he will be back out there, and that's a good thing. Now, I want to give some support information for all you listeners out there. And don't forget to spread this around, this show around. You can go, just spread it around. It's a link on your email. It's worth it, the time. But they're calling for help, of course. Now, they're going to be needing bail money, too, this weekend especially. Now, I have understood there's some reports of a few people are trickling out of the jails there after the 700 were arrested yesterday. However, let's not go with that. You know, let's just assume they're in Kansas. Everybody knows if you get arrested in Kansas on Friday night, you're going to probably be in jail till Monday morning until you see a judge. So that's sort of like where they're at right now. So if you got a couple bucks or something, send them. They only want money orders. Or if you got a case of canned goods or something that you can send that's non-perishable, you can send it. You can send it to this address. It's reference RE Occupy Wall Street, the UPS store, number 118A, box 205, Fulton Street. That's FULTON Street, New York, New York, zip code 10038. Again, money orders only, no checks, no cash. Money orders only, and non-perishable foodstuffs or other stuff, blankets maybe. And by the way, they did remind everybody that you can send any package, the size of any package you want. You can stuff it in a big cardboard box, UPS will get it there. Again, here's the address. Reference Occupy Wall Street, the UPS store, 118A, box 205. Fulton Street, that's spelled FULTON Street, New York, New York, zip code 10038. Also, the National Lawyers Guild is handling most of the legal defense for these people, and their phone number is area code 212-679-6018. Again, National Lawyers Guild, main number, area code 212-678-6018. And they are particularly, you go to Occupy Wall Street, just Google, you know how to Google. and look for the webpage Occupy Wall Street, and the street is spelled S-T. So it'd be OccupyWallST.org. And there is a contact information. They're asking supporters around the country to call the police stations and the main switchboard number for getting these people out, O-R-O, on their own recognizance, you know. And the numbers are all there. Again, that's at OccupyWallST.org. And that's the website with all the phone numbers for people. You should bookmark that also so that you can check in daily and see it. And by the way, there is a live stream available at Adbusters, adbusters.org. Also, at the Fightin' Cock Flyer, we have a live stream. 24/7, this stuff is going on. Now, I'm going to close the show. Normally, I would do some classical music, but frankly, it's time for a little fun like we had with Chuck Young. And here is from Virtual Renderings at the A-Info Radio Project, one of my all-time favorite audio montages that he creates at Virtual Renderings, and it's called Symptoms of a Deeper Malady, and I'll see you Monday night, beginning that's tomorrow Monday night at 10 p.m. Have a great weekend and enjoy this last part.
The most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this prize is the fact that I am the commander-in-chief of a military, of a nation, in the midst of two wars. One of these wars is winding down. The other is a conflict that America did not seek, one in which we are joined by 42 other countries, including Norway, in an effort to defend ourselves and all nations from further attacks.
Mama and Papa were laying
still,
in bed.
We are at war. And I'm responsible for the deployment of thousands of young Americans to battle in a distant land. Some will kill. And some will be killed. And so I come here with an acute sense of the cost of armed conflict, filled with difficult questions about the relationship between war and peace and our effort to replace one with the other. Now, these questions are not new. War in one form or another appeared with the first man. At the dawn of history, its morality was not questioned. It was simply a fact, like drought or disease. The manner in which tribes and then civilizations sought power and settled their differences. And over time, as codes of law sought to control violence within groups, so did philosophers, clerics, and statesmen seek to regulate the destructive power of war. The concept of a just war emerged, suggesting that war is justified only when certain conditions were met. If it is waged as a last resort or in self-defense, if the force used is proportional, and if, whenever possible, civilians are spared from violence.
Hold all earth quiet, filling their brainwashed mind. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started up the war. They leave that to the poor.
It does not matter if the war is not real, or when it is, victory is not possible. The war is not meant to be won. It is meant to be continuous. The essential poverty and ignorance. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact.
I think there's an important connection, you know, between truth and democracy. You can't really think of your country as a democracy if people don't know the truth. And what we are misinformed about is not just the present, but the past. And that is especially important, because if you are lied to about the past, you're not really in a position to judge what you are told about the present. Then, and anybody in authority can get up in front of the microphone and tell you that we must go to war for this reason or that reason.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
And if you don't know any history, if you don't know anything about our past, you have no basis for challenging what you are being told. So we call ourselves a democracy, and we like to think that it's very simple. There are the bad states and there are the good states, and we're the good state. And you know, that kind of sort of Manichaean a division of the world into democracies and not democracies is very, very dangerous, because then those countries which are designated as democracies think that they have a blank check to do whatever they want in the world and it'll be okay.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
Now in darkness, world's upturned. You hear the bodies burn. No more war pigs of the power. Hand of God has struck the hour. Day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling. Begging mercy for their.
Nobel Prize for Peace was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances.
up about the shape I'm in. I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you. I might not give the answer that you want me to.
The more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure, while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America, who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Now when I talked to God, I knew he'd understand. He said, stick by me and I'll be your guiding hand. But don't ask me what I think of you. I might not give the answer that you want me to.
As a nation, must undergo a radical revolution of values. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense and on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual doom.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase
to the masses. Stand up if you're still sane. All of us gone crazy.
Of the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest.
Who would question the goodness of the mighty? We who banish the threat. When your little ones all go nighty-nighty, well, there's no time for doubt right now and less time to explain. So get back on your horses, kiss my ring, join our next campaign, and the empire grows with the news that we're winning with more. Forced our words, and we find that ingenuously churlish words are just words. Don't be so pessimistic, weak and girlish. We like strong, happy people who don't think there's something wrong with pride. Work makes them free, and we spread that freedom far and wide. Sentimental story till they worship.
And if you knew some history, you would not be prone to the notion that the United States is somehow an exception in the world.
We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
This notion of American exceptionalism is something that is so strong in our culture, in our education, that it constitutes sort of a fundamental lie that protects the actions of any administration from really no close scrutiny. When the government is in control of the media, and when the media, in its cowardly way, goes along with the government and agrees and approves of everything that the government does, and then whatever common sense people have is somehow pushed to the side and is taken over by this kind of hysteria about terrorism, and therefore, well, anything we do that the president says against terrorism, I guess, is the right thing to do. But I think what is happening now is that more and more people are thinking about that, and more and more people are thinking, well, are we safer now as a result of two wars? Are we safer now that we've killed more people in Afghanistan than died in the Twin Towers? Are we safer now that we have driven hundreds of thousands of people in Afghanistan out of their homes as a result of our bombing? And that the Taliban, which we paraded as the reason we got rid of the Taliban, is still around in Afghanistan and controls a good part of the country. It seems we are creating more terrorists by what we're doing. You know, the idea of a war on terrorism is, of course, self-contradictory. I mean, aside from the fact that a war on terrorism breeds more terrorists, war itself is terrorism. I mean, that's what war is. When you start a massive air attack on the cities of a country, and you say we're engaging in a campaign of shock and awe, that you're describing terrorism.
There's a soldier lying dead, vultures pecking the eyes out of his head. Another day that could have been me there instead. Nobody loves me here, nobody loves me here.
Death's gonna kill me, death's gonna kill me.
We'll be trapping your in pieces. With every bullet, your risk increases. Old Alibaba, he's a different species. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me here. And
death's gonna kill me. And death's gonna kill me.
If I can live through today. Before I came out here, I never used to pray. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me.
God's gonna kill me.
Well, Dad's in a bad mood. Dad's got the blues. It's someone else's mess that I didn't choose. At least we're winning on the Fox Evening News. Nobody loves me here. Nobody loves me.
God's gonna kill me.
First four trips over to Iraq, I went over and reported specifically on how the occupation was affecting the Iraqi people. So I got to go see things like the aftermath of when a U.S. patrol would be attacked and soldiers would just start firing randomly at anything that moved. So I got to go see countless Iraqis killed by that random gunfire, and go into the hospitals and see the children and the women and the families left behind when Iraqi men were killed. I got to go into Fallujah and see what happens when the Air Force drops 2,000-pound bombs in urban areas and cluster bombs, and what happens to human beings when they're hit with things like white phosphorus incendiary weapons. And so needless to say, after doing this for about 8 months inside of Iraq, I had a bit of rage against the U.S. military, and specifically against soldiers in the military. War is a very dehumanizing thing, and certainly soldiers are dehumanized when they join the military to enable them to be able to go do things like occupy countries and kill people. But also people on the receiving end of that, Iraqis, people in Afghanistan, and also journalists that cover that side of it, we all become dehumanized by war. And that's what happened to me, to the point where I had so much rage after 8 months of reporting inside of Iraq between 2003 and 2005 that my best case solution of what I thought would happen to be a solution to the occupation of Iraq was basically, everyone in the military needed to be behind bars as soon as possible, regardless of their position. And that was basically the best I could do. I mean, I had severe PTSD. I was completely enraged by what I'd seen, and I couldn't understand how people would join the military and go over and do these things to people in another country. If you are there and you intend on surviving, then you need to do certain things. And those things aren't always within regulations, and they are not always pleasant or legal. It is just the situation you are put into. When I was a driver, I was extremely aggressive. I ran cars off the road constantly. It was not the right thing to do, but it was the right thing to do to live. After his vehicle was destroyed by another striker, interestingly, Manziel became a dismounted machine gunner. He claims his resistance to the occupation grew in direct proportion to the Iraqi resistance and not because of any high-minded ideals. He insists, no one wants to be the last guy to die for his unit. And it got to that point where it was pretty obvious that if we did our job, that is what we would be. It was better to just go and hide somewhere. Mosul was a dangerous area and became more so toward the end when we were constantly getting into firefights. I was a vehicle commander at the time, so we would go and drop the dismounted people at some house with an air conditioner where they could kick in a door and hang out and drink tea with those people while we would proceed with the vehicles and bide time out of visible range. Manziel had figured a way to fabricate on-screen movement of their patrol, as I said, and thereby run virtual missions. Quote, sometimes if they called us up to go and do something, we would swiftly send online reports that show that we were headed in that direction. We would manually move our icon on the map to the location where we were being ordered to go, and we would then move it back and forth to simulate real-time patrolling. And ours was not an isolated case. Everyone did it. Everyone would go and hide somewhere from time to time. It may not have been as regular as in our case, but everyone did it because the workload was just too much to handle, and we were all burnt out.
I got my finger on the trigger, but I don't know who to trust. look into your eyes. There's just devils in the dust. We're a long, long way from home, Bob. Home's a long, long way from us. You feel a dirty wind blowing. Devils in dust. I got God on my side. I'm just trying to survive. What if what you do to survive kills the things you love? Fear's a powerful thing. Turn your heart black, you can trust. It'll take your God-filled soul, fill it with devils and dust. I dreamed of you last night, field of blood and stone. Blood began to dry, the smell began to rise. Well, I dreamed of you last night, Father, in a field of mud and bone. Blood began to dry, smell began to rise. We got God on our side. We're just trying to survive. What if what you do to survive kills the things you love? Fear's a powerful thing. Turn your heart black, you can trust. Take your God-filled soul, fill it with devils and dust. Take your God-filled soul, fill it with devils and dust.
Look at overall statistics, according to the VA, of all the female soldiers being treated at the VA, 20% admit to having been raped or sexually assaulted while serving in the U.S. military.
NBC News in depth tonight, back to the front. The number of U.S. soldiers who've had their Iraq military service involuntarily extended under the so-called stop-loss policy is at its highest since the start of the war. That's despite a Pentagon pledge last year to cut back on its use. NBC's Jim Miklaszewski takes a look at the effect of this controversial policy.
As Sergeant David White was preparing to wrap up his military career last year, he was stunned when the Army refused to let him go.
I was just in disbelief. I did not think that something like that could happen to me.
Instead, White was sent to Iraq for his second combat tour, leaving wife Crystal and newborn Eva behind. What the Army did is slap White with a stop loss, which allows the Army to extend the soldier's enlistment, like it or not.
Yeah, I did a good thing. I'm back from Iraq. I served my country. The only thing on my mind right now is to get down and serve big time with family. Bought a house, man, rocking the fruits of my labor. That 14 months of Iraq behavior. That alert, stay alive. Shoot that fucking caper, no doubt. I was making that Iraq paper. Now I'm ready to get on out. Become a civilian again and get on out. No car payment, house all decked out. So I'm set to motherfuckers scream and shout. But success got cost, the army got forced. Telling me a nigga like me is stop lost. That means I can't get out. My salad got tossed. They fucked me over like a mob boss, high horse.
58,000 soldiers have been stop lost in the past 6 years. Their service involuntarily extended from a few months to more than a year.
Enjoyed the show. We'll be back on again, as I said earlier, at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time tomorrow night. Finish with three poems read by Dr. Fred Whitehead. Maybe they'll go to the occupiers.
Four poems by Ed Stone. Seeds. First, scorching to death all life on earth so that they couldn't become contaminated, the three metallic messengers dispatched from outer space carried a luminous suitcase packed with sensitive equipment to test seeds that might inhabit the earth's smoky crust. And immediately set to work in the dust, but found no living seed to test. Then the messenger split the earth like a cantaloupe, and lightly they descended to the hollow center, where they found themselves wallowing in seeds, billions of bleeding, clicking seeds, chanting, "We are the lost teeth of God." Written on a standard, "Only some pleasures are admitted to the palaces of art. Commentary can be intricately conceived, but is averse to a wrought poem. A poet asterisk can never be the burning star of poetry." Ode to a Wounded Artist. "The onslaught of icy dragons is relentless, but bind your wounds, you will survive. You will live and live to create those wonders that make the lovely covenant with thy neighbor's life, which is thy own." "The Night I Saw Heaven." "A devout old man asked me if I believed in God, and I said I sure would if I could see heaven. So the old man smiled, and his teeth were diamonds with rubies for fillings, and his tongue was like a ripe purple grape. So he gave me a pearl-handled telescope 7 yards long and an ice pick dipped in the blood of a lamb, and he told me to await the night of the full moon and to pluck out my right eye with a lamb-blooded ice pick and to look through the telescope with my empty eye socket, and I would see heaven. So came the night of the first full moon, and I plucked out my eye and gazed eyeless at the sky. I saw 7 stars drag racing and a picket line around Mars, and I saw the moon, and it was a white-hot womb in the black, swollen belly of the night. And I saw a busy old man milking 7,000 cows with one quick silvery hand and plowing 7 million acres of sweet, sweaty land with the other silvery hand. Then he drank 70 gallons of golden, glistening home brew, and he laid down on a haystack maybe 27 miles high, with 17 naked, maiden-headed maidens whose laughter banged the sky. So I called to the old man, 'Are you in heaven?' And the old man sat up smiling, and his teeth were diamonds with rubies for fillings, and his tongue was like a ripe purple grape, and he shouted, 'I sure am.'"